the people who live in that culture, they have their own stories, right? They don't need me to write a story about them. But if I can honestly represent it for an audience in my own home culture, then I can sort of humanize what it's like in that part of the world.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is the latest installment of my travel memoir lab episodes. Typically, these tie into the writing classes I teach in Paris each summer, but this episode is actually an extension of the online book club for The Vagabond's Way that I hosted in tandem with Nomadic Matt's Nomadic Network a few years ago. The moderator for that book club was Luke Richardson, who's the author of best-selling archaeological adventure novels, most notably the Eden Black books, a fast-paced, puzzle-driven series written in the style of Indiana Jones or The Da Vinci Code. Last year, I made an appearance on Luke's Adventure Story podcast, talking about adventure writing in the context of narrative nonfiction. I've actually drawn on outtakes of that conversation for the first half of this episode. Then in the second half of the episode, I flip the tables and interview Luke about using your travels to inform fictional writing. Along the way, we talk about the secret to traveling in such a way that you're more open to adventure. We talk about the importance of slowing down and throwing out rigid plans and finding quests, and how even a very simple and low-stakes quest can make for a great story. We talk about the ways that description can be mixed in with action to make the story better, both in fictional and non-fictional stories. We start by discussing my earliest adventures as a traveler, everything from jumping freight trains to living out of a van for 8 months in North America to getting left behind by the Trans-Siberian Railroad at the Mongolian border back in the day. Let's listen in.
Is there a particular adventure that you went on, though, that impacted you more than others?
I think when you ask that kind of question, it's obviously going to be the early life adventures. I've had some pretty amazing adventures in the last few years, but man, I think just a simple adventure when you're young can change your life in a way that it wouldn't if you had the exact same adventure when you're twice the age. So like, I jumped trains in 1992 across the Pacific Northwest. It was only like two or three nights, but like, who jumps trains anymore? Actually, Alexander Supertramp from Into the Wild, he jumped trains that same summer. Fortunately, I lived. Yeah, so that was such an important part of my life. But really, to be honest, it was my very first vagabonding trip affected me. I lived in a van for 7.5 months. I traveled around North America. And I've said before that you can only travel intensely when you're 23 years old once, right? there's something that, but it wasn't just what I did, but it's how old I was. Every day was really special. And I was just amazed to be having these adventures. And it wasn't super crazy adventures, but I was sleeping in a van and climbing mountains and staying in monasteries and partying at spring break celebrations in Florida. And that planted a seed that hasn't gone away.
That resonates with me a lot. Do you think that's to do with age, or do you think that's to do with it being the first time? Because we talk to travelers who are 50 and on the road for the first time, or perhaps even older.
I think it's a first time thing. It's a little bit of both. I think that you're like, when you spend a morning watching the sunrise at age 23, it's just a bigger percentage of your life than when you do it at age 53. But at the same time, I would imagine doing it at age 53, when you've never done it before, the gratitude that you would have, I think you just have a better sense of perspective when you're older. Mm. So I might split the difference on that and just say that sort of neurologically, you're really receptive to things when you're young. But if you're older and having these new experiences, I think you can appreciate them more. You just realize how singular they are, especially if you've lived an honest, hardworking life that isn't as necessarily adventurous as you dreamt it would be. And suddenly you're having these adventures, even though you're in your 70s or 80s or whatever. And then you can think, wow, this is really fun to take advantage of.
It's like that old adage, isn't it? The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today.
Absolutely.
In vagabonding, then, I think you'll admit that's your most famous book. And then later on into The Vagabond's Way, you champion slow, deliberate travel, slowing down, sort of taking things as they come. Why does that attitude, why does slowing down make a difference?
I think it allows you to encounter surprise and serendipity. I think if you're too itinerary driven, if you're too worried about scheduling and going from point A to point B to point C, then you'll just be able to find what you hope to find. You're not going to as easily find something by accident or just have this weird set of circumstances that seems miraculous where you're suddenly watching the sunrise with these amazing people that you didn't know existed the day before. And so I really think it allows you to take advantage of the environment rather than an itinerary. Because if you travel fast, then you're always looking down at your itinerary. You're always thinking about where to go next. Whereas if you're not trying to rush yourself, you can deal with your environment. You can draw from your environment its own wisdom and its own adventures in a way that is way more exciting than whatever you could have planned before you left home.
Yeah, I find that's completely true. I suppose that leaves the door open for those strange things to happen, which are the things that end up becoming the adventure. As writers, we quite often say that truth can be stranger than fiction. And have you experienced any of these real-world encounters, perhaps unplanned ones, that felt so surreal, they felt like they were lifted straight from the pages of a book that you later wrote or a book one of the other classic adventure writers has written?
Yeah, for sure. Oftentimes it's when you get out of the sort of modern industrialized societies and you get into places where the lifeways are much more ancient. Do you know the acronym WEIRD, Luke?
No.
It means Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And I think, you know, in the West, in the industrialized world, we have this assumption that life is like this. You know, it's more individualistic. It's more arm's length. It's not really... Your lifeways are not tied to a specific environment. Whereas most of human history, people haven't lived in that weird way. They haven't been Western industrialized, rich, or democratic. For example, I went into this valley, a very remote valley in Laos. I was on magazine assignment. It was an area that they were sort of trying to develop for tourism, a tour operator out of Thailand. And this woman became possessed by the spirits. And everybody in the village is like, oh yeah, the woman is possessed by the spirits because the chief didn't give a sacrifice when you came into the village. And so by our Western standards, it could be, well, maybe she's just a little bit mentally ill and she's pissed off that the headman didn't give a sacrifice because it's fun to have a feast when guests come and she's just sort of shaming him. But no, they honestly believe that the spirits had entered her and were speaking through her. Well, that was just so strange. And it's, you never see that. And again, if it happened in the West, it would be diagnosed as mental illness or something. I think anytime you go to a place that has non-modern lifeways, you open up to this stranger than fiction type situation. I think also like disaster scenarios, like when I was living in a van at age 23 and traveling around America, I was in Los Angeles during the Northridge earthquake of 1994. And just the fact that this major metropolis trying to deal with a major disaster, I was in Brentwood, which is a very rich part of the city. We had a friend of a friend who was staying there. And so sort of seeing rich people standing in line like refugees outside the supermarket was quite surreal. So I think non-modern cultures and then times when, because of natural disasters or weird circumstances, life shifts a little bit, that's when things get really stranger than fiction.
And I suppose both of those, you're very aware of your position as an outsider looking in. You can't help, you can't change it, you can't affect the situation in any way, but you're there and you're part of it. It's a strange situation to be in.
Yeah, and that's what makes it stranger than fiction. It's stranger for you, you know. Mm. I mean, there's earthquake refugees somewhere in the world several times a year. There's people who believe in spirits and live through the spirits all the time. It's stranger than fiction for your point of view. And I think as writers, this is something we can interpret for people who it never occurred to them that there are people who genuinely believe that the spirit world is an active thing and that their environment is an active part of their life and that even the trees have opinions on who these guests are. And if you can write the story in a way that the Western audience can appreciate, but it also honors the way that people live in that part of the world, then that's pretty cool. And you can create adventures around that.
Yeah. Does that play on your mind, though, that you are writing this for a Western audience? And as such, do you worry that people from the village or people in that situation would read a copy? Because your books are distributed internationally. Would they pick this up and go, this Westerner coming through our village, you know, scoffing at this or whatever? Is that a part of your concern? A bit of a push and pull, I suppose.
Well, absolutely. My second book, Marco Polo Didn't Go There, I put endnotes. And I talk about that in the introduction, is that this book came out, or the stories that were contained in the book came out at a time when, for the first time, you could instantaneously, through the internet, connect with the other side of the world. And not even through a formally mediated level, just through discussion boards of social media. And I realized that if you say that, oh yeah, my guest house owner in Cambodia gave me some free Twaco sausages, you just open yourself up to all this criticism. Like the guest house owner is like, why did you say that? Now everybody's going to want free sausages, you know? And the academic is like, actually, that's not the correct pronunciation of Twaco. That's inaccurate and culturally insensitive. And so I think this is just the way we are right now. And I think one thing about travel writers or people who write about travel in the context of adventure is realizing that you're sort of in a liminal space. You're interpreting one place. The people who live in that culture, they have their own stories, right? They don't need me to write a story about them. But if I can honestly represent it for an audience in my own home culture, then I can sort of humanize what it's like in that part of the world. And I can use sort of my own disorientation and awkwardness to illustrate true things and as part of that adventure. Because oftentimes the adventure, you know, good narrative, as you know, is about sort of moving from imbalance to balance or from not understanding to understanding. And that's something that can definitely be done in a way that benefits both the host community and the guest who is going there.
Yeah. And that leads on to the question I've got in front of me, actually, which is describing that some or many classic adventure stories, whether fiction or nonfiction, go from that balance to imbalance, that discordant to harmony. You know, it's a person in one of my books, they're trying to find a secret thing or solve a puzzle. In a more literary or memoir style book, they're trying to solve an internal conflict or resolution or figure something out. What's something that you've sort of found or discovered, you feel, on the travels that has led to that, that has allowed you to experience that?
Well, I think you're sort of touching on the idea of the quest. If there's something that you really want to find on the other side of the world, then a quest is a great storytelling vessel. And it doesn't even have to be a pot of gold. It can be just like somebody to play racquetball with in Kathmandu or whatever captures your imagination. Maybe there's a recipe that you want to find, or you want to find your old, you know, ancestral village in Central Asia or wherever you go. Then you end up having these really interesting experiences. For example, my wife and I went to Kenya a couple of years ago looking for this old camp that was established by some Americans who were from the same part of the US as we are, who were documentary filmmakers like 100 years ago when it was really new to make documentary films. And the camp is a sort of, they were famous in the 1920s, but nobody knows about them now. And nobody in Kenya really cares who they are. But we went all the way up to northern Kenya to this place called Lake Paradise. And we eventually found the old place, the old camp where they had the old dark room where they developed their film. I say the old dark room, actually the ruins of this place. We found old nails that once held together boards there. And by the time we got there, it really wasn't even about finding the place. It was about all the experiences we had along the way. It was getting scared by the water buffalo down by the lake and meeting our military escort in this national park type area. And the soldier assigned to us was this really cool woman who was about 30 and she had kids and she was funny. And so I think that sometimes the quest is ultimately not about what you end up finding, but it's about the meanderings and the serendipities that come along the way.
I think that's absolutely true. Sounds like something Paulo Coelho would write, isn't it? It's what you've got at the beginning. You know, you had it all along, perhaps, the thing you were looking for.
Yeah, for sure.
So travel writing, I think, does give the perception, or can give the perception, that the writer aimlessly wanders around, stumbling into these amazing situations. Is this true, or do you find that you have to cultivate those experiences? Like thinking about your Kenyan trip there, there must have been an element of planning that in advance of just sort of rocking up.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of both and. I mean, this couple also tried to climb Mount Kenya and they failed pretty miserably and the woman almost died. This is 100 years ago. Well, now there's like a trekking industry there. So we climb Mount Kenya, no problem. It's not like we're stronger than they were 100 years ago. It's just that we had the advantages of a commercial adventure travel industry. And that's worth keeping in mind that right now you can buy an adventure. Like it used to be that you just had adventures. You flew your plane into the bush or you went down the river for 2 weeks. Well, now you have commercial planes that you do the same, or commercial boats that do the same thing as well. And I don't want to knock the commercial travel industry, but I think that sometimes if you don't allow yourself to meander a little bit, then you're only going to find what you hope to find. You're not going to find those wonderful accidents. And this is why going slow is a good thing to happen. Like when I took the Trans-Siberian train, I knew I was going to write about it, but I didn't know that there's going to be a really boring 7-hour stop on the Russian-Mongolian border and I was going to wander outside and sort of meet some people and hike around and come back and the train was gone. So my cousin and I went, we realized that when you take the Trans-Siberian train, the timetable is only on Moscow time. So even if you're in Siberia, even if you're seven time zones away, the train is going according to Moscow time. And so we're just these dumb Americans who completely misunderstand something that's no secret about how the Trans-Siberian train works. And so we had to hire a taxi to catch up with the train, which sounds like this cinematic wild adventure until you realize how slow the Trans-Siberian train goes. But we didn't know that. And so we hired this guy to, well, yeah, I wrote about this, but like this really cool Siberian lady who spoke English, introduces this taxi driver, and she's like, well, be careful because oh, I can't remember, I can't think of what it is. And it's like, well, he might break down, it might be late. He's like, oh, kill, he might kill you if you're not careful. And it's like, what? and so I think something was lost in translation where she was telling us not to trust everybody. And the crazy thing is that I feel like the taxi driver was a little bit more afraid of us than we were of him, because I think this woman said, you need to be good to these Americans. And he was trying to catch up with the train. And then he also, they have these animistic beliefs. Like every time he crossed a mountain pass, he would throw out coins or like cigarettes out the window. So for the first hour of the trip, it's like, why is this guy throwing money out of the car? Anyway, we caught up with the train and it was no problem at all. But that was not an organized part of the adventure. But because it was a misadventure, it made it way more interesting from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, and it sounds it. I can imagine that now. What's the greatest length then you've gone, if it was an organized adventure, or some of the adventures that you've had to sort of pull a few strings behind or put some organization into? What's the greatest length you've gone to get that ideal adventure story?
Well, probably the biggest example for my travel writing career is the No Baggage Challenge in 2010. I went around the world with no luggage for 6 weeks and with just things in my pockets. And so that's just a constraint, right? That I didn't go anywhere that far off the beaten path, but I went there with no bags. And people really were engaged by that. They just liked the thought of what it would be like to travel the world. And people said, oh, I wouldn't want to sit next to you on the plane, you know? It's like, I didn't say it was the no bathing challenge, it's the no baggage challenge. I was as clean as ever because I had to wash my clothes constantly because I only had a one backup set of clothing. And so that's a big example. But I think anytime that you sort of give yourself an obstacle, like once I walked across the north part of Israel, and so I just had to go slow. I think walking anywhere is going to give you an adventure simply because it is by nature inefficient to walk from one place to another. Some Americans and I bought a riverboat and we took it down the Mekong River in Laos for 3 weeks. And that was an amazing adventure that was structured, but it was structured only in that it's like, oh yeah, we're driving down the river in a boat. I bicycled across Burma once, and so, or Myanmar. And so I think anytime you can structure the quest, but as long as you don't micromanage the quest, it's going to give you these amazing experiences that you had no idea existed before you went off on the quest, be it a quest with no luggage or trying to ride a one-speed bicycle across Myanmar.
When you come to put these things down on paper, then you must face a tension between staying true to what you exactly saw, telling it as it is, and sort of making it a compelling story, trying to tell it in a way that's really engaging to the reader. How do you balance those two interests in your writing?
Well, that's when I'm envious of people like you, Luke, because you can embellish, right?
Oh, yes.
In the world of fiction, whereas in nonfiction, I think travel writing has a bad reputation because historically it hasn't been super reliable. But I think that the metric on where you can sort of cut corners in terms of what literally happened is that you can condense time and you can condense characters or you can leave things out, but you can't put things in. I think in nonfiction, it's sort of, you're not being honest if you talk about something that didn't happen or a person that didn't actually exist. Actually, it's narratively hard to describe 10 interesting people that shared a train car with you. And if you maybe condense them a little bit, if you take the best lines and you have them coming out of the mouth of two people rather than 10 people, I think that's a fair way to tell a narrative nonfiction story without bending the truth too much. But it's a tough, I teach travel writing classes in Paris each summer, and this comes up every year. It feels like this story could be more interesting if all of these happened in one day instead of 1 week. Is that ethical? Well, let's talk about that. Usually, you're not really stretching the truth that much if you're just condensing time or condensing characters a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose no one wants to see you sat on that Siberian railway for all of the hours that led up to that moment.
Yeah.
And your inner monologues and the things you ate and the things you... That's not going to make interesting stories. So cutting to where the action is makes for a much more interesting thing.
That's the nature of storytelling. I tell my students, like, if you saw this big brawl fist fight in the bar the other night, you don't start by saying, oh, I woke up and I had some eggs and... Then I went to the bar and I had three beers and I went to the bathroom and the urinal cakes were pink and that's really interesting. No, you don't. You start right in the middle. There was a fight. Like when you go home and you tell your friends about it, you don't start chronologically and tell all the details. You start in the action. You simplify the chronology and you start in media res. That's fair game when telling stories.
I agree with that completely, although I amp it up to 12, you know, when doing those things too. But then that's fiction. That's the wonder of it.
Yeah.
So as travellers and as writers, I feel like we do often walk that line between scepticism and wonder, and there's a balance there. Have you ever encountered something, though, that left you genuinely amazed, like speechless, you just didn't know how to explain it in that moment or to sort of justify it in that moment?
Yeah, there are quite a few moments like this, and often they happen in these indigenous cultures like I was talking about earlier. Like, I was in Vanuatu on the island of Malekula last year. I was with my wife, but I went drinking kava. Do you know what kava is, Luke?
No.
It's an intoxicant drink. It's sort of a narcotic drink that they drink in the Melanesian South Pacific. And it's a very mellow high. It sort of relaxes you and you become a little bit mystical. It's the ritual, women can drink it now in Vanuatu, but usually it's a men-only ritual. And it's sort of bro time. It's like we go and you figure out the universe. And actually in Vanuatu, they encourage people to drink kava instead of alcohol because people drink alcohol and they get in fights. People drink a lot of kava and they just talk about the nature of the universe, right? And so I was hanging out with these guys at a kava bar on the island of Malekula, and they were just sort of talking about different things. And, you know, they were curious about me. And they were talking in Bishlama, but I was with a guy who could translate for me. And then they just pivoted and they started talking about magic and about how this guy jumped on the rock and the rock took him to another island. And then he flew back. And it's like, I don't think there's an airline. No, they were talking about flying through the air as if they were talking about the weather, right? You know? And so this is a world where magic is still much more a part of the way they interpret how the world works. And it was just really weird. It was sort of a weird privilege to be a part of this conversation where these people... They weren't showing off. They weren't trying to dazzle me. They were just sort of matter of fact talking about, you know, the news from the week. And I've never been in that situation before. There have been other situations like I went to the Mentawai Islands off the coast of Sumatra, which is still sort of Stone Age in the way they live. And even just being in a place where there's no plumbing on the entire island, I think that sometimes, again, you compared with the modern world, you just are really amazed by how people see the world. Like one guy before he fell asleep, he was singing to his father. His father had died the year before. And so he was just sort of singing a morning song. It's really interesting how connected, like before we ate the chicken, they thanked the chicken for giving us dinner, right? It's like, you've lived well. I don't know exactly what they said because I didn't speak their language, but their attention to food, you know, we eat meat unthinkingly in the industrialized world, whereas they were acknowledging that this chicken had lived a good life and it was going to enhance their life. And so that's the kind of thing that really blows me away. When you asked that question, I was thinking that sometimes there's Western rituals that might mystify other people from other cultures, like spring break in the United States, when college students go to the coast and party, or Mardi Gras to an extent. I mean, in New Orleans, Mardi Gras is carnival, like they have in Venice. Just the way that, I guess, the touristic approach, the hedonistic approach in the 21st century with which people celebrate Mardi Gras and spring break, I think would mystify people. I think that the Bacchanalia is recognizable across history, but the very specific consumer culture of Bacchanalia in the United States would mystify other cultures in the same way that people talking about jumping on a rock and flying to another island mystified me.
Yeah, I think even things like living on your own, you know, in our culture, you think, I've got my own apartment, it's great, it's got all these things. You say that to the guys you were talking about there, they'd think you were really sad for not being or with your family or with your friends or whatever.
Absolutely. I've heard that before. Even when I was in my 20s and traveling through Asia, it's like, oh, where's your wife? Oh, I'm not married. Oh, you're 27 and not married. I'm so sorry. Like, just family is the starting point for people's happiness in so many parts of the world. Not just their happiness, but their way of interpreting the world. That it's sort of funny to sort of take one's individualist assumptions into parts of the world where individualism is sort of seen as an embarrassing, self-indulgent thing.
And this sort of follows on from the question you've had there. What's the most unexpected joy you've discovered when you put that itinerary aside and just let serendipity guide you? Just let that, you know, the feeling of the moment take you and control your itinerary.
Probably my favorite experience is I went to Cuba. This is in the mid-aughts. I went down to Cuba. I thought I was going to write a book, a travel book about learning to dance. I thought, well, the most challenging thing I can do is not climbing some distant mountain. I've done that before. It's this big, clumsy, awkward Midwesterner learning how to dance in Latin America. And I went there and I took some dancing lessons, but I ran into a friend of a friend who played the bagpipes, and he introduced me to the Bagpiper Club. And the longer I stayed in Cuba, the less interested I became in dance and the more interested I became in these cool bagpiper people. And they were just they were in their 20s, they were hip, they were good looking, they were a lot of fun. And so instead of learning to dance, obviously I never wrote this book, Luke. Instead of learning to dance, I just made some great friends. And sometimes we would be out until 5 in the morning. I learned how to play a few very poor songs on the Galician bagpipes. And we would stand outside and the Cubans thought it was really cool, and Cubans will dance to anything. And so we would go out and play the bagpipes and meet people at 3 in the morning. And it was a terrific time that I never would have assumed. You know, I think people go to Cuba and they think, oh, I'm going to dance son and I'm going to smoke a cigar and drink a mojito. Well, no, actually, I played the bagpipes and it was one of my most memorable travel experiences ever.
I really hope there's some video content of you playing the bagpipes at Cuba at 2 in the morning.
I think there might be a very primitive 10-second clip from like whatever Olympus digital camera I had back then.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I ask this question at the end of each podcast episode because we're talking about adventure stories. Looking back, what adventure stories, whether books, whether movies, whether actual sort of told legends by grandparents or whoever, first sparked your imagination and made you want to see the world?
Anthropologists use a term called the tourist imaginary. It's like you go to a place that there's a real place, but then there's also the place you imagine you are. And I think growing up in my generation, being a teenager in the 80s and a young man in the 90s, Indiana Jones and Star Wars will always inform my tourist imaginary. Even if it's accidental, you know, if it feels like I'm sort of in an Indiana Jones scenario, then it feels really exciting to me, even now that I'm in my 50s. So I want to tip my cap to those sort of adventure movies from when I was young. But actually, you know, I started out doing van life. My first journey was in North America. And when you think about North American travel, you think Jack Kerouac and Dean Moriarty traveling across America, having these amazing experiences. But actually a big influence on me was William Least Heap Moon, who wrote a book called Blue Highways. Have you heard of this book?
No.
Yeah, he was a middle-aged guy who kitted out a van and he'd just been divorced and he drove around. And weirdly enough, when I was a young man, that interested me. Like there was a structure to the way he traveled that was more influential to me than this crazy madcap Jack Kerouac journey that happened. And so it's funny looking back to those early influences. Blue Highways is a big influence to me just because it sort of showed me that this van life was possible before there was a term called hashtag van life. And then when I was traveling around Asia, I really loved Video Night in Kathmandu by Pico Iyer, because his was a travel book about Asia that acknowledged that people in Asia play baseball and they watch movies like Rambo. And it just felt really relatable. Yeah, it's really fun. I can actually, do you know the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
I do, yes.
Yeah, it's a great travel movie. The guy skips school and goes to downtown Chicago. It doesn't go very far, but it's sort of proof that you can have these adventures close to home if you just risk to take the adventure. And so there's movies like Before Sunrise, which is all about getting off a train in Europe with an attractive stranger and just sort of letting things happen. Stories sort of are part of all of our imaginative lives. Even as people like you and I create stories, we were relying on the stories that inspired us. Sometimes they can be counterintuitive, but they're always fun. I think the stories that we read sort of teach us how to tell stories.
I think that's absolutely true. Never thought of Ferris Bueller's Day Off as a travel film, but now I'm going to have to recategorize that for sure.
But tell us about the adventure stories that you write. Just, again, eventually we're going to talk about how your travels have informed your adventure stories. But give us a little sort of an elevator pitch for people who might be interested in reading your stories.
Sure. So the books I'm most known for now are archaeological thrillers. So they involve missing manuscripts, ancient curses, secret civilizations, lost civilizations, this sort of thing. And my heroine, my main character is called Eden Black, and she goes out to save the world, basically, from this bad thing, this really bad thing that's about to happen. But of course, they're always set in a different place. You know, she's in the Caribbean, or she's in the Sahara, the last one I wrote, or she's on the wreck of the Titanic in the North Atlantic, was one that happened earlier in the series, or she's on the Trail of the Templars in Europe, wherever that might be. So it's just putting her into the situation, and off she goes to find this thing that promises to save the world.
Well, in a second, I want to talk about the travels you've done and how they've informed this heroine's adventures. But let's talk about influences, because immediately you said archaeological thriller. I think, oh, Indiana Jones, right? You know,
yes.
His overlap with with Petra in Jordan, right? You know, that's the location of the Last Crusade. So, was Indiana Jones an influence on this series? And what else has been an influence in the literary realm?
Yeah, people talk about Indiana Jones, and I say that if they're not particularly if they know that, I'm like, yes, that's a good comparison, because it does dovetail quite nicely. The Lara Croft franchise, the Tomb Raider franchise as well, is another good one for comparison. If we're talking about books, I lean into things like Clive Cussler is a comparison. But also there's the sort of riddle side of the Dan Brown series. You know, there's the history of a place that she goes to, and we've got to figure out that the secret is in the stained glass window that is only lit on a certain morning at a certain time of the year, you know, and she has to come and find something that's projected on the floor in a certain place, and that's where something's buried under a specific tile or something like that, you know. So it does play into that sort of esoteric clues are around us in the architecture and in the things that we see as we walk around these famous sites.
Well, it occurs to me, I don't know much about where Dan Brown has traveled or how he travels, or Clive Cussler, or even Steven Spielberg. But what about Luke Richardson? how do actual travels inform the fictional travels of the books you write?
Yeah, it depends, right? And I wonder if your writing process is like this, because sometimes I go to a place having already got the idea and sometimes having already started the book. And my trip there is really just to sort of take in that invisible source that going to a place gives you, the smell of the market, you know, those little phrases that people use all the time that you couldn't pick up from Google Maps, or the how ferocious the traffic really is. You know, you visit Cairo, I went to the pyramids to research my book, The Giza Protocol, and you just that, the absolute sort of craziness of the traffic driving towards the pyramids, and you see the pyramids on the horizon, you know, and you're getting closer and closer and closer and closer, and they're getting bigger and bigger, and you're stuck in traffic the whole way, this 5-mile road from central Cairo into towards Giza. But it's those sorts of details that I like to put in those trips. And other times I go on a travel, sometimes purposefully, to not think about writing, because as writers we need a holiday as well. And of course, they're the times when an idea sort of jumps into my mind and goes, "Hold on a minute, have you thought about this?" And then I have to sort of get on that. I have to make doses of that, take notice of that, and note that down for a future story.
Are you drawing on travel that existed before you were a writer? I mean, are there experiences that you had when you were just sort of wandering the world with your backpack that have made it into your stories?
Oh, certainly, particularly the early stories that I wrote. And I reference one particular trip frequently. It was my first trip to India that I went on in 2011, 2012, something like that. And it was my first time out of Europe properly. And I just remember, I've got this avid memory now of getting out of the airport first thing in Mumbai and being in the back of a taxi and taking that freeway drive
between the slums and looking out of the window as people opened their tarpaulin doors and the kids were running out of the huts and they were warming up water for breakfast and chickens were pecking at the side of the road and the trucks and the donkeys and the holy cows walking around everywhere. And that sort of overwhelmingness of the senses and the feelings that come with that, right? Because when you're a traveller, you don't just see it, you sort of feel it in this real sort of deep way. And that idea that this is the scene every morning for people that live there, right? That's always the way. That's their life. And I'm seeing this for the first time. And I feel very proud that I've seen it for the first time, because there are many people who would never put themselves in that situation. And I feel a little bit sort of guilty that I come here from, I have a house that now no one's in for a month whilst I'm in India, you know, and yet there are people here living on the side of the freeway. But it's that sort of awesome childlike wonder that I experienced in the back of that taxi in 2012. That's my vision for someone when they read a book that I've written, and I want to take them to a place with that same amazement. It's a big ask, I think, but that's my dream. That's why I do it.
Yeah, I've thought that sometimes that as a travel writer, I often take the most notes on my first day, just because everything seems so new. I'm not used to anything yet. And so, how do you record things as you travel? How do you record the experiences in such a way that when you're back at your desk writing the novel, that nothing is lost from those travel
experiences? Yeah, I always say that we need to do the thing first. If we're going to see somewhere, we need to do it in the first couple of days that we're there. Because if you sit around for a while, you're right, you just lose that edge. You lose that excitement of being in the place. It becomes slightly normalized, doesn't it? And I think the more you travel, the shorter that window becomes. So you really need to sort of go and do the thing as soon as you can. So how do I keep that? How do I remember that? I take a lot of photos. I sometimes record things. You know, if you're nothing, I'm not a photographer in the sense that I take perfect photos in a real dramatic sort of way, but just those snaps of things, you know, just those quick photos of the things that you want. Also recording voice notes and taking notes on my phone, things like this that I'll take whilst I'm out in the field, as it were. But nothing really that puts anything between me and the place. I want to be really present in that place and very aware of that place whilst I'm there. I think that's important.
Do you ever do interviews? Do you ever sit down and say, hey, what's it like to live here? You know, or tell me a story about your life.
Not consciously, although that would be fun. And actually a few times, or once I can remember, stories have come out of conversations, whether they're with taxi drivers or tour guides or people in the hotel, you know, and ideas have come from those conversations, which I wouldn't have had I not have got into there. But yes, actually structuring that in a way is to say, yeah, let's have a conversation about that. Could be really interesting, for sure.
Well, as a travel writer, that's a nice pretext. It gives you a pretext to interview people, you know, to be curious, you know, almost as a raison d'etre. I'm curious, like, do you write about stuff? Is everything that's in your books things that you've experienced either directly or tangentially, or do you have to speculate about things? Like, what happens when you can't go to a place? How do you write about that, or do you not?
No, I do. I do. It's a good question, because there are places that I have written about and haven't been able to go to. And it's a question I get quite a lot, actually, from authors wanting to write about places for one reason or another they can't visit. And I think there's lots of things you can do. The internet is a wonderful resource, of course, for us at the moment with Google Maps and YouTube as well. There are people, and I've seen them walking around cities, who take one of those 3D cameras on a stick, and they will just walk up and down the streets of the major cities for hours and hours. And then the result is like a 7-hour video of every street in Lisbon, for example, or every street in Paris.
Then do they put it on YouTube? Okay.
Yeah, you just put walking tour of so-and-so, and it's just someone who's done this walk. Anyway, they're really useful for that sort of thing. But I also think another way is to get in touch with that culture where you are. So if I wanted to write about a place in Vietnam, for example, we've got a Vietnamese restaurant here in Nottingham in England where I live. I could go there and I could sample the food and hear the cadence of the language floating across the restaurant from the kitchen. Hear the music that's playing on the radio, no doubt, you know, tuned to, I'm imagining this now, but tuned to, it's tuned to a online radio station that reminds the chefs of home or something like that. And those little things can just give you the edge, give you the taste, make that writing, give that writing a bit of personality. So it's not literally just like the place you live with a different name. You know, you've put something into it that lifts it up a little bit.
How do you deal with expectations and cliches of place? Because, for example, you know, you want to bring something new, but to a place, but you don't want to have. Well, maybe you could have an adventure story that takes place entirely in a 7-Eleven in Thailand, even though that's not the typical stereotypical experience of Thailand. It is something that is everywhere in Thailand. So, how do you balance sort of what the audience expects of a place, like you don't go to Giza and not mention the pyramids, with surprising them and giving something that might be culturally insightful in a way that a novelist who doesn't travel couldn't do?
What I try to put into the story is the different layers of a place, or perhaps the duality that a place has. A place, this is very, very obvious, is Mumbai, which I referenced a couple of minutes ago. And in that traffic jam on that first morning, there was the slum to the side of us. There was sports cars, which would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, next to people walking with no feet, next to someone riding a donkey, next to, you know, 200 people crammed into a bus. And that idea that the city is different things to different people, the place is different things to different people, there are different layers of life within that place. I think, as of course there is, when you think about it, that's a really obvious thing to say, isn't it? Because a city involves millions of people, or even a town that involves hundreds or thousands of people, they're all different. So just sort of separating out those layers and showing people as the nuanced group that they are, I think, for me, lifts the writing in a way that shows that you've gone there. And also you've been respectful of the people there. You've been honest and sort of open to who they are and what their home is like.
Huh. You know, every year I teach a travel writing class in Paris, and I have certain kinds of advice. And so I'm curious to know, like, what kind of advice would you give to people who want to write about travel, but in a way that is sort of extrapolated into these sorts of adventure stories that are obviously more fictional? What
Sure.
techniques would you offer the traveler who might want to fictionalize their stories?
Yeah, I think the important thing to know with adventure stories is that the story is first. The story is the engine of the book, you know, in the way that if we use a car analogy, right, the story is the thing that gets it from A to B. The setting and the place, whilst that's absolutely important, because you don't want to be in a car without all those nice things like seats and windows and whatever else, right? They're important, but it's not going to go without the story. The story needs to drive the thing forward. The story needs to move the thing. So forget that at your peril. And I did this in some of my early writing. When I look back at it now, it's very much like the story stops for a chapter as I describe this market scene to you in all of its intricacies. And now when I went back to that, I've rewritten that particular story so that there's a chase scene through the market.
Ah.
And so instead of me describing the pyramids of onions piled up, this was in Kathmandu, the pyramids of onions piled up in Kathmandu, the bad guy slides through the pyramid of onions, skittering them all over the place to the raucous cries of shoppers and merchants. You know, instead of talking about the smell of the smell of frankincense from the incense cellar, the hot coals get thrown from the from the fire across the floor. Well, you know, you're turning a thing into an action rather than just a description. You're putting it into movement, putting it into something kinetic so that it moves the story forward.
Yeah, that's cinematic too. It feels like there's a lot of chase scenes in markets. You just now mentioned those, but like, yeah, what a great place to put a chase scene. So
yeah, exactly. And I've spoken to a few writers as well who make that mistake of setting a scene. They're in this wonderful place, but yet they set a scene in a really uninteresting place. So, example, the person has been arrested by the police and they're in the jail, right? That's really boring, isn't it? How can you tell that? Why not set that interrogation scene in the back of the police truck whilst they're on a mountain pass, you know, going through the Himalayas or something like this? Because that allows you to pull in those details like we've talked about, you know, to let the reader into that world rather than shut them out of the world like it would do if they're in that jail cell. So the story is leaning into that too, I suppose, is what I'm saying there.
And do you get this, these sensibilities, you know, these instincts for putting that chase scene in the market? Is that just something that experience led you to do that, or are you drawing from other kinds of narratives too? Because when you were talking, I was thinking about like police procedural TV shows. They never interview somebody like in an interview room. Like they talk to the guy, but he's works at a meatpacking plant. And so he's like doing his meatpacking work and they're interviewing him. It just like that, you see that so often in police procedurals, but of course it makes sense because it's more interesting than just having that conversation in a place that's featureless, right?
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with a retired policeman on an author's podcast some time ago. And this guy said, how many times did the mortician invite him into the morgue and tell him about the dead person over the body whilst the body's lying on the table before him? He said, never. Huh. It's always sent as a PDF attachment to an email.
Right.
And yet every single story like that has them going into this mortuary. The dead guy's there on the table and they're talking, you know, the guy's there, the mortician's there poking and prodding and pulling bits out and weighing them and whatever else he's doing whilst the police are on the other side of the table. And it's exactly that. It's you're telling the story, but you're doing it in the most visually or the most interesting way for the reader or the viewer in that sense, I think.
For the travelers who might be listening to this, how do you know when you have a good story? How do you know when you're in a travel situation that has potential to be a bigger story that you can take home and maybe make your own hero and have her do an archaeological or other kind of adventure? What sparks and sparkles at you from travel that really lends itself to stories?
For me, it's that element of mystery. I love to go to a place and feel like, even though I've done my research on it, it still doesn't quite explain to me what this place is, what this thing is. There's an element of like, there's a like gray area between what the experts think it is and what it could be, you know. And I'm not saying all these conspiracies about left, right and center or whatever, but the point I'm saying is that there's just that element that there's more out there. You know, the Sahara is a big place. Is there something underneath it? What's the Antarctic ice? Is all of these things, the deepest ocean on the world, all of these things are mysteries that even with the best science, we don't fully understand. And that for me is where the story is. It's in that little bit that we don't fully understand. And that's the intrigue that I think my stories lean into.
Yeah, there's a little overlap with nonfiction travel writing too, that you're going to a place that is full of mystery because it's not yours, you know, that you're
sure. Yeah.
You're trying to understand why people act in certain ways or why food is prepared in this way. It might not be a matter of digging under that Saharan sand for treasure, but you are very gently uncovering mysteries. I think there's a lot of overlap between fiction and nonfiction.
I think so. I think so. And I think it's important to remember in this situation that you are your book's first reader. So if that mystery, whether that be a something under the Saharan sand or a mystery about how people in this place do that thing and it hasn't transferred to your place of where you live, if that interests you, if that intrigues you enough to spend 6 months of your life writing it or longer, right? If that intrigues you enough to do that, the chances are it will intrigue someone enough to read that book as well. So that is important to me. I sort of think if it intrigues me enough, then that makes a good story.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Luke Richardson's adventure novels, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.